Possessions, from a dog, a gun, and time enough. Possessions, if they are worthy of the name, possess the possessor as he possesses them. They are singularly his if there are no others exactly like them. Looking out the end window of the long room through tall rhododendron to the fieldstone springhouse with its big iron dinner bell under the overhang, I see it as a hand-built form over 200 years old like this house, giving me a sense of time and continuity and rightness, and I feel a possessiveness of everything that is old hemlock, removing all the people who have lived here and used it and mistreated it or loved it before Kay and me. We have three waters out of our land, crystal, pure, each of different mineral content and flavor. The spring inside the spring house, flowing day and night, whether we are home or away, pours out of the hillside and overbrims the carved stone basin to fill the shallow milk trough that provided cooling for milk and cream and butter for the early residents and gave us refrigeration for 10 years before the electric was brought into this region, emptying into the 20-gallon tile overflow of cold drinking water for the old hemlock setter since blue. Salt, sweet water, seeing the light of day for the first. There is the upper hickory spring in a 1,000-gallon underground concrete reservoir whose 50-foot drop gave us gravity flow and running water in the house in the years until electric power was available. It gives us water still with a turn of a valve when power fails in violent storms. Spring water with a sec limestone taste, good for the bones. And there is the drilled deep well that never diminishes, the water we use most for its healthful mineral balance. I hold it to the light at dinner in a cut glass tumbler, clear, cold, full-flavored, nothing less than elixir. We bathe in this glorious liquid like bathing in Puyi Fuise, a drink for a king. These are wild mountain waters out of high land, waters that belong only to us and to no one else before. That is possession. Walking up our lane with Kay, with our sugar maples sifting gold, I try to think what it would be like to see such a house with its boxwood, sleeping away its centuries under these giant trees in the dignity of solitude, and not possess it. And I grasp that Indian summer and all of this is just for Kay and the setters and me. Half-wild lavender rockets come each June, growing on the grounds, as on other early homesteads, brought by pioneer women years forgotten from I don't know where, perambulatory blooms seeding themselves to migrate from the springhouse area into the abandoned orchard or the old garden plot. Another year, they are a sheet of vibrant lavender in surrounding woods, always moving, always with us in June, spots of color and fragrance among new green. Possessions are a symbol not of wealth, but means. The means to happiness, to see the simplicity of this land, the house and its objects that live because I love them beyond price. The moment you put mere price on things you possess, you denigrate them. This chair, which fits me as if it had been poured around me, shed its antebellum black horsehair for the blue velvet under my hands, generations after it had been in the house of a cousin of Stonewall Jackson. That it should kindly accept me from across the Mason-Dixon line is a gracious thing. My fingers find the tooth marks in its carved walnut arm, and I see Briar again as a puppy, innocently looking up at me as he gnawed it. Sitting in this chair, I held Bliss in my lap after cleaning our gun on countless shooting days, nursed Ruff while trying to eat breakfast balanced on a tray. I have probably used and loved this chair longer than Kay's ancestor who first owned it before the war. Belton and Quest are spread on the floor near me, watching me from the corner of their eyes. I almost make the mistake of counting them among my possessions, but dogs are so much more. When men love dogs, it would be only kind if they would live twice as long as man. But who would look after them when we were gone? To care is knowing it will end. Perhaps that is why it is so comfortable to love a gun that will outlive you by 100 years. I stand among the mammoth hemlocks on the southern end of our land and lay my hand on their enormous girths and own them and feel like God. I viewed the great springhouse white oak as immortal with its 22-foot circumference. And then in 1974, in a summer storm, I learned what mortality was. 13 years later, the hole in the sky is beginning to fill in with tall sugar maples and hemlocks, and the massive stump is crumbling, eaten by fungi more than 300 years after it sprouted as an acorn. Sometimes it is the small thing that lasts. I saw a miniature crystal jewel box with its sterling cover on my mother's dressing table as far back as I can remember. Then it was only glass with a tiny Greek female on the silver lid, drawing an arrow from a quiver about to shoot at a deer. Now, as with many things we come to see differently, I cherish it as a charming relief sculpture of Diana, who metamorphosed Actaeon, the hunter, into a stag, later torn to pieces by his pack of 50 hounds. I question the ferocity of her modesty. All he did was see her bathing, but that is the legend of the hunting goddess. There are no things in this house we do not love, perhaps because our maturing tastes have set value upon that which is closest to our lives. I look around at a milk glass lamp and a student lamp that illuminated our evenings in the first decade we lived here, at wrought iron thumb latches and spear end hinges that serve us as they served those others before us, at a chunk of sandstone from the barn foundation that evolved under my sculptor's chisels into Ruff's head in his prime, with eyes that seemed to follow me still as they did in life. A spirit that entered the stone as much from his sensitive beauty as from any talent of mine. There is an antique china clock on our bedroom mantelpiece, its rococo form hand-painted with flowers in bone a long time ago. Several years my senior, it came from my parents' house and sets a good example of survivorship from treatment no clock should have to endure, stopped each night to quiet its ticking and striking that would disturb our sleep, restarted each day when I set the hands and give it a jerk, upon which its pendulum picks up its heartbeat in the rhythm it left off. Charming old thing, your family, your aging, yellowing face, telling off my hours. My guns mean too much for me to tell of here, like the hundreds of coverts I possess, but there are those many small associations with shooting that at heart are memories. There is a ragged shooting vest I can't discard because of a blood stain soaked through the game pocket from a woodcock shot over a high standing point by Bliss a generation ago. On my gun cabinet ledge, there is an Abercrombie & Fitch gift card from the old Madison Avenue store with an engraved buck a-leaping, inscribed, "To the shootin'est gentleman from his followin' lady," conjuring up a faraway Christmas after the war. Possessions are not possession alone. They involve responsibility on the part of the possessor, a concern for the future, for in a sense they are your offspring. Only you could have brought them into being exactly as you have loved them. It is yours to see that they are cared for and, if possible, loved by someone else. There is a factor that will affect these things that are part of you that is more than the erosion of time, the indifference, if not actual greed, of strangers who do not care. I see it in certain attitudes toward grouse, those magnificent birds I want to see go on forever. It is particularly evident in the constant pressure to exploit the land, improve it in the form of subdivision for recreation, The hunger of Thoreau's financial pauper who can't afford to let things alone. Nothing is more touching than to see the belongings of someone recently gone being scattered to the wind like the dead flowers from his grave. The spectacle of a public sale with the babble of the auctioneer setting prices on possessions that once were priceless. There is a story of a house in the Poconos in northeast Pennsylvania. It had been the home of a setter fancier containing his treasure of old sporting books and Edmund Ostow's prints. For a year after his death, his son kept the house and his father's possessions intact. Then one day he saturated the walls with gasoline and touched a match to it in a symbolic funeral pyre, reducing everything his father had loved to ashes. The impact of the story has stayed with me, but over the years the initial shock has changed, and I wonder if the son didn't, in a way, dignify his father by placing those possessions his father had cherished, including the house, beyond the grasp of profane hands. Old Hemlock is not just a house and trees on 200-odd acres of the earth's skin. It is a possession all the way down, converging to the core, radiating upward to the mountain constellations, whose starlight in some strange way purifies the air. Looking out the sunset window through an interweave of hemlock branches, I see the big trees getting bigger. They, like the old clock, tell the time is passing, telling us that we have lived more fully than we dreamed when Kay and I were dreamers. These things I love. I need only time enough to possess them.